it was a very, very strong presence on my shoulders, around the back of my neck, all down my spine, on the top of my head. And it was God.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That is the UK's leading Christian magazine, and it brings you this show every week. Do check out our website for the latest subscription offers and the latest news and analysis from a Christian perspective. That's premierchristianity.com. Here on The Profile, we like to speak to a different Christian every week and hear something of their life story. And I'm pleased to say that my guest on the show today is Sam McKee. He is a scientist, philosopher, historian, a polymath with 9 qualifications across 4 disciplines. He oversaw a winning team which had its experiment flown to space by SpaceX to be conducted by astronauts on the International Space Station in June 2023. He speaks regularly on topics including science, faith, philosophy, and he's also on the committee of the Mars Society UK and also Christians in Science. I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit about all of that in the time that we have today, as well as Sam's life story. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
We like to start at the beginning here on the show. So why don't you just take me right back to early life? Tell me something of life growing up, what family was like, and perhaps where the Christian faith first came into the picture for you.
Well, I was born and raised in Northwest London. My bedroom window looked out on the London Underground, so it was about as London as you can get. We were dirt poor. It wasn't easy, but I was taken to church when I was a child. I had a very Sunday school experience, you know, colouring in the Ten Commandments green and sticking it on the fridge, singing songs and eating sweets, that sort of thing. It was quite nice, but in general, my childhood was quite difficult, quite a mess. It was a very broken family. We moved to Buckinghamshire when I was 8, and we started going to a Pentecostal church, but in general, I'd say my experience of church was largely negative. It was something that took me away from my friends. I wasn't allowed to play football. And I quickly learned at school that it was not, you know, if you're a Christian who goes to church, you're going to have the mick taken out of you. So
yeah,
I kind of switched off quite a lot. My brother and I actually used to have a race to see how quickly we could get kicked out of church. Which involved all kinds of tricks and pranks, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But I very much was sort of pushing against and rebelling in my early teens. My parents got divorced, my mum remarried, and it wasn't easy. But I found myself sort of at a crisis point when I was 15, and I actually became a Christian on my own. At 1 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of the summer holidays, in my bedroom, I couldn't sleep, and I'd had a run of nights where I just couldn't sleep. And I, for whatever reason, I just assumed the Holy Spirit set me up. I got a Bible off my shelf at 1 o'clock in the morning. I thought, well, I need to read something to help me fall asleep, and I just happened to pick the Bible that I'd been given when I was born, and it had my name and date of birth written inside the front cover by my grandmother. And I mean, this is the extent of where I was at. I thought, I'll read the ending first, and if I like the ending, I'll read the rest. So I turned to the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, and needless to say, it didn't put me to sleep. It was like nothing I'd ever read. It was not what I was expecting. I knew of Jesus, you know, being born in a stable and riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, and here's Jesus, very, very different in the book of Revelation. So I read the whole thing, and I woke my mum and my stepfather up at 3 a.m. and asked them to explain the book of Revelation to me.
Oh, wow. That's not a task anyone wants at 3 a.m., is it?
No, I still don't think I really understand it. But I was fascinated with the Bible then, and I felt like there was something I was missing out on. I was missing out on a great truth that had passed me by. So I decided to go find my own church, and I went to an old Pentecostal church full of much older Christians, no young people, And I had a very simple faith, and it was really, really great. I'm very glad of that. I went to the school Christian Union. There was a very vibrant Christian Union scene, and there was quite a strong moving of God amongst the Christian young people there, and my school in particular, and that really spurred me on. So that's how I came to faith.
So you were turning up in church, what, sort of 15, 16, teenager, and you'd had that experience in your bedroom reading Revelation. So I guess you're kind of brand new to everything. What are your memories of in your teenage years? Were you sort of eagerly drinking it all in, or was there sort of still challenges in your life at that time?
Oh, I had massive challenges in my life. I ended up sort of out of home at 18, and my A-levels were very, very difficult experience. But God was definitely there. I was a good little fundamentalist. You know, anyone told me anything, I believed it. So, you know, for better or for worse, that's what I was. And my wife, long, long, long before she was my wife, invited me to Soul Survive when I was 18. That was a big turning point experience. And I did a gap year with my Youth of Christ Center. I just, because of everything I'd been through, I had this heart to sort of help other young people who were struggling. So I ended up not going to university, but instead becoming our church's first ever youth worker. And I was working on a really tough estate, living in the flat above the church. I just sort of stuck my flag in the ground there for 6 years. It was absolutely wild. It was completely mad. You know, I had death threats, had my flat vandalized, my car vandalized, my my office broken into, got punched, kicked, stones thrown at me, like everything. But we turned that place around. You know, God really moved. It was a good story. And I ended up staying in youth ministry. I went back to Youth of Christ after that, and then worked for another church. And then before you know it, I'm, 30 years old, thinking, wait a minute, this I've suddenly got a career in youth ministry. That wasn't the plan at all. I'd had very different dreams. But my faith sort of consumed me. I was very passionate fundamentalist there.
So tell me more about what those other dreams were, because of course now a lot of your work is in the area of kind of science. Was that part of your childhood, becoming really interested in science, biology, explaining how things work?
Yeah, absolutely. No one in my family went to university at all, but I have vivid memories of I was a very bright child. I memorized the entire London Underground when I was 9. I could draw it all out from scratch on a blank piece of paper, which is very odd. Who does that? But I had a very sharp memory. There's two things in particular. One was I went to the Natural History Museum when I was 5 or 6, and it wasn't the dinosaurs that got me. It was the giant blue whale model. You know, if you've been there in Kensington, it's huge, life-size model of a blue whale. And I was absolutely captivated by that and stunned that we knew so little about them. So, 6-year-old me is just going to the library all the time, pulling out every book on whales that I possibly could. And also when I was 7 years old, Helen Sharman became the first British person to fly in space. And then the year after that, Michael Fole had his first mission to space, the British American NASA astronauts who went to space 6 times. And he was my hero. He was absolutely my hero. I wanted to be him. So when I was 9, I actually had this grand plan that I was going to get into grammar school. I was going to study biology or marine biology at university. Then I was going to go to Oregon State University, which was the only university on the planet where you could do a PhD where you researched blue whales. Then I was going to become a naturalized American citizen and join NASA and be the next Michael Fole. So that's 9-year-old me has the plan all mapped out.
The plan, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was, all that mapped out at 9. That's
yes, extraordinarily detailed for a 9-year-old. But, as plans will be, plans go awry. And, things went off the rails and didn't go according to plan, really. But when I had my twins, I remembered all that, and I actually took a week off and went walking in the fields and prayerfully thinking, Lord, life has sort of happened to me rather than gone where I was going to go. So what should we do? And I drew up a 10-year plan to turn things around. And I had been doing a theology degree part-time when I worked for the church, but had left before it finished. So I finished that. I studied immunology for a year and then found that wasn't for me, but I fell hard in love with genetics. Genetics was a completely captivating, extraordinary thing. It was, where have you been all my life, was what it was. You know, day one, lecture one, this is all I want to do. So I went to Cambridge, I studied genetics. Then I went to Birkbeck to do molecular biology. By the way, when I finished my theology degree, I had really enjoyed it, even though I hadn't chosen to do it initially. So I stayed on to do a research master's in science and religion. And then I parlayed that into my first doctorate in history and philosophy of science, which I'm just finishing now. But then once I finished at Birkbeck, I was offered a fully funded second doctorate at the University of Reading in DNA repair. And the university is not far from me. So DNA repair was absolutely my favorite field and the thing I really wanted to get into. And it ended up having all these interesting crossovers with the space sector. So ended up getting involved with that project that got flown to the International Space Station. And my only science publications so far have all been involving DNA and space. So it's funny how these things come full circle. That project that I got to do that went to space, that was a project I was working on, and Michael Foll was leading the event. So I think God has an interesting sense of humor with these things, which was brilliant. But that's how I ended up sort of coming back into science in my 30s through to where I am now.
Yeah. And it sounds like if I'd met you in your 20s, you would have been quite happy saying, God's called me to some of this amazing youth ministry and church ministry. And it sounds like if I met you in your 30s, you would have probably said the same of some, God's called me into science. And, you know, was it kind of that simple for you that there's no contradiction there, that God can call you into either churchy stuff or sciencey stuff? Yeah. And it's and both of those things have been things that have been right for you at various points in your life, I suppose.
I think that's true. Certainly people can be called into both. In many ways, I don't think youth ministry ever leaves you. You know, if it's been in your heart, you know, look at Youth of Christ, there's loads of 60, 70 year olds still in hoodies, jeans and Converse, you know, passionate about young people. But I would say in my late teens and 20s, I was living 100% in the present. I wasn't thinking at all about the future. It was all about the need that I see before me right now. Whereas now I'm looking at, you know, the whole of the rest of my life. How can I make the best impact with my life, both for myself, my family and the work, but also for the kingdom? I've been around so many extraordinary older Christians who spent their life in the sciences and academia, and they are very inspiring to me. And so now I've probably got a bit more of a thought through vision of the short, medium and long term. Whereas, you know, when you're in your 20s, ball of fire and passion, and you're kind of living more in a fundamentalist environment, it's all about the now.
Yeah. You mentioned I think you called yourself a good little fundamentalist at the beginning of your kind of Christian journey. And I wondered if that would have applied to your views on science and how that's been for you over the years in terms of, has it ever felt like a tension between science and faith? And presumably you've encountered all sorts of different Christian views on science. I'd be interested to know what that journey's been like and kind of where you've landed on some of those issues that get debated a lot. I mean, especially things like evolution, where some Christians would say, no, I reject that because of my reading of scripture, and others like yourself would say, no, I think I can be faithful to scripture and also believe that God guided that process of evolution.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I'll start with the personal. It's a real shame. It's a real regret and a sadness looking back that I was a young person who had, passions for science early on. And I was in an environment where, firstly, if you're a Christian, you don't have a brain. Don't have a brain. It's all about your heart. It's all about your feelings. you know, I'm pretty sure the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But I was being fed a diet of half of that. You know, it's your heart and your soul, all of that. And mind and strength, now forget it. That's a real shame. And yeah, I was being fed everything from the prosperity gospel to young earth creationism in large doses. And I just believed everything that I was being told, unquestioningly. And that is a real shame. It was a terrible witness to my family, because my family, no one had been to university. And I'd had my grandparents, you know, rubbing my shoulders when I was 8, 9 years old, saying, "You're going to go to Oxford and Cambridge. You're going to do so well. We're all so proud of you." You know, I remember that. And then in my teens, in my 20s, going into my 30s, I was sort of this cautionary tale in my non-Christian family of, you know, what he could have been if only he hadn't become a Christian. And it's interesting now how that's changed so much. You know, that's completely turned around, but it was a bad witness, and it's a shame, really. I believe God is redeeming the time. But yeah, I was card-carrying creationist back then, and the irony is now the intelligent design and creationist people don't like me very much. yeah, I've been quite critical of intelligent design and those things, because I believe that we as Christians, you know, we have the biggest vested interest in truth. And I'm very inspired by great Christian scientists of the past, and they would never have approached things with a creationist point of view. There's a strong disconnect, because I believe, as Sir Arthur Eddington, who was a great Christian scientist at Einstein's time, said, that the chief element of science and religion is seeking. It's the spirit of seeking that drives us, and it's pushing yourself out there on the frontier. And as a seeker of God, I'm seeking him wherever I can find him. As a seeker in science, I'm always looking for data, truth, where the path is leading. And I see a lot of those fundamentalist elements of just trust what the authority tells you, and don't really look for yourself or follow the evidence where it leads. In some of those creationist and intelligent design things. I also, you know, from my education background, I respect the grind. I respect people who are pursuing truth and pursuing knowledge and solving problems. And Christians should be at the forefront of that. And a lot of the people in the creationist and intelligent design circles, they've never been in research, that they've never been in a lab in their lives. A lot of them, they don't know about the latest research at all. You know, biology is so, there's never been a better time to be in biology. It's the biggest boom since the 1950s right now. Biology is so exciting. I say to students all the time, this is such a privileged, awesome time to be in biology. And then you have, you look around for well-funded ministries that market themselves very well. And they're still talking about evolution. And they're talking about things that, you know, were maybe relevant in the 1990s. But do you know where biology is now? Like, the last decade has been a huge revolution. And I mentioned things to intelligent design people that Nobel Prizes have been awarded for in the last few years, and they don't know what I'm talking about. They've never heard of it, but they go church talking about, you know.
Yeah. Supposedly. Well, if a creationist, you know, heard that, they might respond and say, "Well, hang on, there are creationists out there who do have very good scientific qualifications, scientific knowledge, you know, working in these areas," and they would say, "I believe the Bible teaches this view of creation, and I believe there is science to back it up." I mean, those people exist who are credible scientists, is what a creationist would say to you. I mean, do you deny that, or do you think, well, yeah, there might be people like that, but they're not credible?
Yes, I do, because you need to read the fine print. You've got to dig a little further. It's frustrating to me. I meet people who are young earth creationists who have a PhD, And, you know, you look, they got their PhD, either they got their PhD so they could be a professional creationist and they have absolutely no interest whatsoever in contributing to their field, which is sad. It's a bad witness. Or you have people like, I don't want to be starting a fight here, but, you know, take someone, some of the people at Biola who teach intelligent design in the apologetics modules, or people like Doug Axe. You know, they're trumpeted as these PhD biologists who've published in journals. Then you look closer and they've published three times. And their last publication was over 20 years ago. Or you know, people say, oh, look at them. You know, he's a real authority. Well, where? If you actually, I wonder if these people have ever met a scientist in their life. Like, you know, it's science. The grind of science is you're publishing all the time. You publish every year. And you've got to publish in top journals and you've got to be collaborating. And it's so jarring sometimes being a Christian in the science world where the grind of science operates and research operates and you're always about the latest stuff. And, you know, I have to tell students off who are quoting textbooks that are 5 years old because they're horribly out of date. And then you go into the Christian apologetics world and there's, oh, this guy's a real authority in science because he's got a PhD in cosmology. And I look and they've never published anything and they've never, that they don't know any of the latest data. It, and an atheist is not going to be impressed by that. They're going to take the St. Augustine approach of it's shameful for a non-believer to hear a believer speaking ignorantly of the things of nature, because if they hear you speak ignorantly of the things of nature, they will not hear you when you talk of the resurrection of the dead. You know, Saint Augustine gave that warning in the 4th century, and it's still true today.
Well, sadly, we're not going to solve this debate on this call right now, but it's great to hear your perspective. I think I'd love to bring it back to your story a little bit, because you talk about moving. So you talk about being part of a fundamentalist church where you were told a version of the prosperity gospel and creationism, neither of which you find credible anymore. Can you take it back to a moment in your life where perhaps those switches were happening in your mind? I mean, can you remember that process of sort of changing your mind and thinking, wow, I've got this wrong? And presumably for you, it wasn't a case of I've got the whole faith wrong. It was just, no, my particular doctrinal understandings in these areas need to shift. I'd love to hear a bit about how that happened.
Yeah. So studying my theology degree was so valuable. There were two things in particular that I appreciated about my theology degree. One was you had to study a different religion every year. You had to do a module on a different religion. So year one, I did Islam. Year two, I did Mormons. Year three, I actually asked permission to do New Atheism, and they agreed, even though it wasn't on the syllabus, which was great. They had such a healthy respect for the Bible at my theological college. And you were only allowed to study Genesis in your last year once you'd really got the tools under your belt. And it was digging into Genesis as a Hebrew text, you know, as a Jewish text, and using the textual criticism tools that really transformed my understanding of it. And it's definitely my favorite book of the Bible. But I look at it in completely different lenses now, and it's much the richer for it. In terms of things like science and religion, I just met far too many extraordinary scientists who had a deep, rich faith that I was jealous of. And I suddenly realized that none of them were creationists, and they all believed in evolution. And I thought, wait a minute, so why do I not? What's my problem then? And it actually was the very first time that I went back and didn't just believe what I'd been told when I was a teenager, but actually looked at it for myself. And I found so many wonderful, wonderful believers who really looked at it. Actually, my dissertation in my theology degree was defending theistic evolution to charismatic evangelicals. I met Simon Conway Morris, who's professor of paleobiology at Cambridge, and I hold very warm affection for him. I've got to work with him every year for the last few years. John Polkinghorne, who's sadly passed, you know, was another big influence on me. It was just looking at evolution and having a rich experience of the processes of life and finding it to be sort of the dance, the story, the music of creation. But then in my science and religion master's, I was really peeling back the history. And I really found the history, particularly of the 19th century, to be completely unlike what the creationists had told me. Like, the creationists were completely wrong about what the 19th century was like. And this comes up a lot in philosophy of science. And so when I was doing my PhD, I had an excuse to dive into that a bit more. But I think the biggest thing was I'm sure you know C.S. Lewis pretty well. I took my kids through The Magician's Nephew. And in The Magician's Nephew, when they arrive in Narnia, but it's just cold and dark and black, and there's nothing there. And then they start hearing a song, start hearing the sound, and then the light comes, and then things start to grow, and Narnia comes to life with the song of creation slowly beneath their feet, and the witch can't bear it, and she flings this iron bar at the head of Aslan to try and make the song stop, but it just bounces off his head, falls to the ground, and then even the iron bar starts to grow and becomes the lamppost of Narnia with the song of creation. That was actually quite transformative, seeing creation as this song that's ongoing, with life itself infused with God's creativity. It was just such a richer experience for me.
Bible sales are up. Alpha attendance is up. Young people's interest in God is, you guessed it, up. It's been called a quiet revival, but is it really true? This month, we're bringing you expert analysis and stories galore of God on the move. Enjoy a year's worth of Premier Christianity magazine, including this landmark revival special edition and full digital access, all for just £30. Visit premierchristianity.com. Moving forward a little bit, I know you had a period of what's sometimes called deconstruction, where it happens, I think, to a lot of Christians for various reasons, become disillusioned perhaps with elements of church or elements of their faith. And I know that happened to you to quite a serious extent, including some depression. If you don't mind sharing a bit more about that time, what exactly happened for you?
Yeah, so this was 7-8 years ago. Yeah, I'd been in ministry. Even though I was studying, I was still working in ministry. But I won't get into the details out of respect for all involved. But I had a really horrendous experience of church. It was just completely mad, and it flipped me upside down. And I watched my best friend lose his faith, one of my other best friends lose his faith. And it's not that obviously deconstruction was in vogue, but I wasn't looking for it. It found me because I could not put the pieces together of how I'd been living my life for God and how my experience at church had been. And it was church local, but also church further afield. I found myself really on the wrong side of the Christian world, and I couldn't understand why. It just sort of spiraled out of control very rapidly, and it didn't seem like anyone was really looking out for us. My wife had just had our youngest, so she was out of work on maternity leave, and I had lost my job working for the church, and no Christians would hire me despite my track record and my experience. So when the church turns its back on you and the world turns its back on you, where do you go? And so I was out of work, and it was getting desperate and desperate. And my faith was shattered. It was a shattering experience for my faith. Nothing made sense anymore. Church was not a safe place for me. I'd not had anxiety or depression before, but I found it was just somewhere I couldn't bear to be. So I would drop my wife and children off and then just go for a walk, sit in a coffee shop, or at best just sit in creche with my daughter and not talk to anyone. And I didn't go to church for the better part of a year. And for that whole year, I was unemployed and just spiraling because I was not in any fit mental state. And God just seemed to be nowhere, just was not there. Either not interested in me or punishing me or didn't exist. Now, unfortunately, deconstruction is really unsatisfying. So, you know, there weren't any answers there. So I was just sort of left floundering. I didn't want to believe or not believe anything without good grounds for it. It's like Alex O'Connor, the atheist, says, you know, you can't force yourself to believe. You also can't force yourself to not believe. But I wasn't, you know, I was not going to church. I hated church. I could not read the Bible and I could not pray. My praying was just a God help, God why, God please, you know, amen. I had a really humiliating Christmas, you know, just very shameful, you know, not being able to get a job when our family needed money, and just feeling like such a failure. And New Year came and went, and that's when I started getting my first thoughts of throwing myself off the motorway bridge. And that's terrifying because they're not your thoughts. They're just invading. And I, in my pride, just thought I was above and beyond this. This couldn't possibly happen to me. It happened to other people, but not me. And that was very frightening. But the new year comes, the new term comes. I was studying at Cambridge at the time, and I was doing these intensive weekends with a lot of international students. And the first weekend of the new year came, I drove to Cambridge, not thinking about God or faith or anything, just looking forward to controlling the only thing I could control, which was my academic life. And we were supposed to have a day of lectures. I remember it so well. It was a beautiful day, and I'm down at Mattingley Hall, and for a day of intensive lectures, and there's no labs in Mattingley Hall, but my very eccentric professor had brought all kinds of lab equipment and had transformed our lecture theater into a makeshift benches. And he says, I know we're supposed to be studying, I'm supposed to be lecturing you today, but we're going to spend the day researching green and red algae. Yeah, surprise. So I was just getting ready for, you know, observing algae and making notes and on all this stuff. And then we were going to be doing an assessment out of it. And that day I had the most profound life-changing, life-saving experience of God I've ever had in my life. And it changed the course of my life. It probably saved my life as well, to be honest. And it's very, very difficult to put into words. It's pretty much impossible. Well, I can only say that I was not ready for it. I was not looking for it. God was the last thing on my mind that morning. But I went to my bench and I just looked down at this algae, and I had about a 30, 40 second experience that was, you know, that's not a long time, but it's certainly not a short time. It's long enough to go, oh my gosh, this is happening. Am I crazy? No, this is actually happening. What is going on? And I looked down my microscope at this algae, and whilst I'm looking at the algae, it felt like heaven, the transcendent, the divine, whatever label you want to put on it, just very suddenly came into the room. It was a very physical, tangible experience. It was not in my head. It was all throughout my body. No visions, no words, nothing like that. Just a very, very powerful presence, physical experience of the divine, wrapping around me, taking firm hold of me. And I dared not look up from my algae. I just looked at the algae the whole time while this was going on. And as I said, there were no words at all, but it was a very, very strong presence on my shoulders, around the back of my neck, or down my spine, on the top of my head. And it was God. It was the transcendent. And what the powerful feeling was that I got from it was God knew who I was and I wasn't forgotten. It was like, I know who you are. I know who you are. I haven't forgotten you. For about 30 to 40 seconds. And as soon as it finished, you know, this tremendously out of breath physical experience, I stepped back and I looked around, and no one else was feeling anything. Everyone was just going about their business, looking at making their observations, chatting, completely normal. And then the sudden awareness that this had only happened to me. And as real as it was, I was the only one who had experienced it. And I just immediately made for the toilets. And I cried for about 10, 15 minutes. I had no assurance. I had no concrete evidence I could hang on to that everything was going to be okay. But I drove home different that day. I had a sudden, undeniable experience of God being real and being with me. And it was about a month after that, everything turned around. I got a job and I just carried on with my studies, got on with things for the next couple of years through to the pandemic. And my faith changed shape. I mean, it adapted. It has to with these things. But I keep photos of that algae with me everywhere, on my phone, on my iPad, on my laptop. My wife says I can't put them on the wall of the house, but they're my permanent reminder that God knows who I am and remembers me. And gosh, I mean, that was the only way God could have got through to me, where I wasn't going to argue my way out of it. It was not going to happen at church or the Bible or in a prayer meeting or anything like that. But God met me in the lab. And I don't know anyone else who has an experience like that. There's no one I could relate to. And I went through a lot of therapy trying to process it among everything else. Ultimately, I feel very, very blessed, very fortunate to have had it looking back. But it was the perfect thing in the perfect way at the perfect time. And it changed me forever, really.
It's an amazing story. And I love how it was that sense from God that he knows you personally. And as you say, that it happened in a place that is so personal and special to you, a lab. Mm. And I suppose as well, you know, nature of scientific work, which is very rigorous, you know, you've got an academic background, you've done a theology degree, you're used to sort of thinking things through up here in your head. But it sounds like this experience of God's, it wasn't a intellectual thing, it was a spiritual, personal, experiential thing as well. And is that significant as well, that for you, understanding God, yes, can happen on that theological head knowledge level, but also clearly you're someone who can say that you've had a personal spiritual experience as well, and your knowledge of God is not confined to your brain, if I can put it that way.
Yes, I mean, I'll say again, I was a good little fundamentalist where it was all about your feelings and all about your experiences and all of that when I was younger. It was a very satisfying, deeply satisfying merging of worlds, I'll put it. Being in the lab and experiencing God in that awe-inspiring, terrifying, magnificent way that I will never fully understand. It was is a very precious merging of worlds and bringing a wholeness to me, I think, in my life in a new way. I went home. I drove home different in so many ways. And it's a story I kept to myself for quite a few years. It was actually on Unbelievable back in September, talking to John Wyatt. I just casually mentioned I'd had this experience with algae, and some of the Premier team were like, "You can't just say that and then leave it." Like that's so I shared the story, and now I feel a bit more free to share it. It was the most personal experience of my life. It was so incredibly personal, like God reaching me in a way that no one else could ever have done or understand.
Well, it's lovely. And thank you for sharing it with us. As you say, it's a very personal thing to share with others, and we appreciate it. It's always so encouraging to hear stories like that. I wanted to talk some more about your scientific career. Now, we're going to have to start with SpaceX, because you've mentioned it already briefly. But, I mean, this is the stuff of dreams, I think, for so many people. So you had an experiment flown to the International Space Station by SpaceX. Do you want to just explain a little bit more about what that experiment was and your involvement in it? And it must have been a dream come true.
Yeah, I mean, my dream is still to be an astronaut, but I've probably only got one chance left at my age of making the European Space Agency, unless some private crews or if Axiom are listening and want to let a DNA repair guy go to space. So, I mean, a lot of it was circumstance. I was engaging in this competition. There's this amazing organization called ISET that sort of work with NASA's education arm, and they go around the world city by city running these programs for 14 to 18 year olds. Whenever they're in the UK, I help them out. And there were about 500 students involved. And I was managing a team of 8 or 9, just shepherding them, helping them design an experiment to fit very, very strict parameters. And lo and behold, our team won. And it was a brilliant experiment. I was shepherding them and guiding them, giving them advice. You know, they had this idea that they wanted to do something to address the biofilm problem on the ISS. And I thought that was a terrific idea.
Just for those who aren't aware what that is, do you want to just explain exactly what the biofilm problem on the International Space Station is?
Well, a lot of people don't know this, but astronauts have to spend about an hour or two a day cleaning, which is a very costly use of time. Many people will be aware that your immune system is suppressed in space, you know, so it's a lot easier to get sick, and it's a lot harder to get well when you're sick. And on the surfaces of the space station, and this applies to any spacecraft, I guess, you try and keep it as clean as possible. But these colonies of biofilm do grow, which are, you know, microorganisms that colonize together, and they make this fine sheen sort of film on surfaces. So you see astronauts, you know, having to go around and clean surfaces every day, because if you get these communities of biofilm, you're going to get sick a lot easier than on Earth, and then it's very, very difficult up there. So that's such an expensive use of astronauts' time. And so we were looking at the experiment. NASA changed a few things about it, but for our experiment, it was just trying these slightly different versions of, I think we settled on silver nitrate to purify surfaces from biofilm and see if they grew back much slower as well. So it was both cleaning them a lot quicker, but also seeing that they didn't grow back as quickly. And it was good. It was successful. There's this brilliant photo of astronaut Nicole Mann in the cupola window of the International Space Station, looking down at the Earth, and she has this box with the ISET logo on it, and she just spins it in the window, looking down at Earth. And you think, like, wow, somewhere in there is our experiment. It was so satisfying as well. It was SpaceX CRS-29. It was a night launch, and night launches are the best. And just seeing that rocket and going, you know, somewhere on there is a little tiny piece of me and these 8 or 9 teenagers who we were shepherding. There's this little box that was what we designed. But so they can write that on my tombstone, I guess, at the end. But hopefully it's just the first of many.
Well, I was going to say, while we're on the subject of achievements, I'd love to hear what your other sort of standout moments are from many years working in these fascinating areas that encompass biology, history, philosophy, space. What are the other, you know, the other things you're sort of most proud of, I guess, in your career?
Well, in many ways, I feel like I'm just getting started, just on the edge of things. But I love what I'm working on now. What I'm working on now is... your DNA is under assault every single day, and from all sorts of different things, and your DNA breaks, and we have these remarkable DNA repair mechanisms that keep us alive. And there's 5 different forms of DNA repair. I'm looking at one called mismatch repair. You know, your DNA is A's, T's, G's, and C's, and sometimes the wrong letters are matching, and you have a problem. It causes kinks and bulges in your double helix, and it can cause genes to be wrongly expressed or not expressed at all, and so your body has to repair these mismatches. And there's a family of DNA repair proteins that are my principal study. They're called the MUTE-S family, you know, the MUTE family of proteins, and they stick together like Lego bricks. And if you get these mutations in the wrong places, they can't stick. And when they can't stick, they can't clamp onto the DNA double helix, and they can't repair the mismatch, and then bad things happen. You know, bad things being colorectal cancer, for example, or Lynch syndrome, some pretty vicious forms of cancer. And so I'm you know, doing a thorough structural examination of them, looking at some ways that you could develop potential treatments for when these break down, but also hopefully some preventative measures as well, you know, where you can give your DNA a helping hand. And the thing is, because your DNA is never under more assault than when you're in space, there's been this crossover with the space sector on seeing how you could stop astronauts on the surface of Mars, where the radiation is 80 times the level of what it is the surface of Earth, from getting sick. And you never know where these things lead. I'm also a big fan of CRISPR-Cas9, the gene editing tool, which the Nobel Prize was awarded for a few years ago. And I got to do a project exploring some therapeutic applications of that to non-small cell lung cancer. And that's just, it's such an exciting time to be in biology. I love teaching at the university. I love teaching my students. It's never boring. My life is never boring.
I think what's great in what you just shared there is people can sort of see quite easily and quite quickly the real world application of some of these ideas. Although they are incredibly, you know, incredibly complex scientific ideas, you're also really saying that in time it's possible we might get some cures or some preventions for some cancers, for example. I mean, how, on a big picture level, like how much should people be anticipating those sorts of massive issues like cancers being potentially solved or at least changed dramatically through scientific progression, like in the foreseeable future? Is that something that's a reality in terms of the potential for science to make massive strides forward when it comes to people's health?
Absolutely. The whole world of cancer is going to be so different in 10 years. The Nobel Prize was awarded for cancer immunotherapy in 2019. I believe, perhaps I'm wrong, you know, just 7 or 8 years ago. The Nobel Prize for CRISPR was awarded in 2020. You have the Nobel Prize was awarded last year for AlphaFold, which is a tool I use every week. There are tools we have that are so much better than anything we've ever had. And they've all landed very recently. And they converge, they help each other. So there's this sort of snowball effect. You know, cancer immunotherapy is sort of the thing that everyone has been waiting for. And it's so effective. It can rescue people who've been sent home to die. And it can bring them to a full recovery. And the cancer won't come back. You know, that's the dream we've been waiting for forever. The problem is one course of it costs $500,000 for one course for one person. You know, the costs have to come down, but they will come down. This is such a recent technology. More biotechs, more startups will get involved, will learn more. More people will publish in it. More people will get into the field. You can see a path to this happening. I am a techno-optimist, and I consider myself a futurist. You know, I'm thinking about what the technological world will look like in very positive terms. My frustration with this as a Christian is the Christians should be the people at the forefront of that. I mean, we were at the beginning with the Royal Society. They were all Christians at the beginning. You know, the people sitting around a room saying this new thing called science, let's put it to work for the glory of God and for the good of the common man. You know, they were all Christians, and we've ceded this ground to the humanists and the atheists, and we had no reason to give that up, and they don't have any right to claim it as their own. But, you know, it's frustrating when you do have good Christians that no one's ever heard of doing incredible work. I mean, look at Christians in science. It's like the most beautiful, amazing collection of incredible Christians on the planet. And the church just doesn't know who they are. The world knows who they are. But meanwhile, the church is going around saying evolution didn't happen and talking about science as if the 21st century hasn't happened yet. It's a frustrating place to be in. because there's so much great stuff happening and there are Christians there involved in it. But we've got to get their voice back. I think that would do so much for people's faith. It would do so much to inspire, but also it would be a very powerful witness to the world, I think.
I'm really interested in what you just said about being, I think, techno-optimist was the phrase you used. And I'd love it if you could apply that to some of the conversations around artificial intelligence and AI. Because there are, again, lots of different Christian views on this. But I think there is a view which is quite negative about AI, which says, well, we are made in the image of God. Human beings really matter. And people worry that we're just going to sort of give everything over to the robots, and the robots are going to run everything for us. And it speaks to kind of human dignity, especially with things like work. Actually, work is good. We're created to work. We shouldn't want to live in a world where no one works and ChatGPT writes all my articles. Maybe I'm getting a bit too personal here. I quite like what I do. I don't really want to give over the editing of the magazine to ChatGPT. But flippancy aside, if there comes a point where ChatGPT can edit the magazine to a greater standard than I can, a lot of people would say, well, why not just let the robot do it? So anyway, there's a lot of ethical conversations and debates going on. But what's your take on AI and how Christians should respond to it? And is there a more kind of positive Christian view on AI?
So I'll speak in terms of AI and biology, because that's what I know. AI is definitely a blessing and a curse. The curse for me is trying to write, mark brilliant assignments by my undergraduate students and thinking this is so good, it must have been written by AI. did AI do your homework? And looking at everyone's homework and thinking, gosh, did AI do all your homework? And what do I do with that? So that's the curse side of things. The greatest gift of AI, in my very biased opinion, is to biology. This is something I'm so thankful for a long, long time. In fact, forever until very recently, the protein folding problem has been one of the great challenges of biology, because when it comes to macromolecules, proteins, peptides, DNA, RNA, people understand that the structure is what matters. The structure is really important. Proteins are the most important macromolecules in your body. They do all your jobs. And they are like snowflakes. They're all different shapes. And that's beautiful. Biology is beautiful. Yeah. But they're also like keys. You need the right shape. A protein that's the wrong shape is not going to do its job, or is not going to do it as well. Occasionally it mutates and it does it even better. And that's great. And that's evolution. But it's really important that we know the structure. Now, when you're developing medicine, when you're developing drugs, you have to get the structure right. But up until very recently, we had absolutely no idea how you get from the DNA code copied into RNA, ferried out of the nucleus to a ribosome, fed through the ribosome like tape running through a machine, and then out comes the protein that immediately takes the shape it's supposed to take. And we had absolutely no idea how you get from the code to it being the shape. And it's not a slow process with lots of intermediaries. It, bang, immediately is in the right shape. And you think, how does it know? How does it do that so fast? The code doesn't seem to suggest any, the code doesn't say take this shape in ways that we could really understand. But if you're going to make the right drugs, the right medicines, you've got to get the shape right. And so how can we develop the code that gives us a drug that's the right shape? It's just such a massive problem. And then you get AI involved and machine learning a few years ago. Now, I work at the University of Reading, and we have a lab and a team that I'm a part of that enters one of the biggest competitions in biology that happens biannually called CASP. And CASP is a race between labs and organizations all over the world to figure out the protein folding problem. You are given one code, and through the programs that you've built, the software you've built, can you nail the structure just from the code alone to 100% accuracy? And it's been running biannually for, you know, we just had CASP 16 last December. And generally, up until a couple of years ago, everyone's AI machine learning sort of methods were batting about 50%. And that sounds bad, but if you're nailing it half the time or you're getting half the structure right, that's pretty good. And then Google's DeepMind entered the fray 4 years ago with AlphaFold and immediately hit 80%. I mean, it was doubling what a lot of people were going. You're like, what? What is this? This is incredible. And then the next competition, so just 2.5 years ago, AlphaFold 2 hits 88%. And you go, oh, good grief. We could be about to solve the protein folding problem. And then last December, AlphaFold 3 came along, and I think it cleared 90%. The results are still being processed now. What happens when AlphaFold or one of its competitors hits 100%? Here's what will happen. Yeah. Drug discovery takes 5 years from, you know, concept to product on the market on average. What if you could do it in 1 year? What's that going to do for medicine? What's that going to do for, you know, there are diseases that have been untreatable that we could solve. There are things that were seen as impossible that were suddenly, you go back and look at them again and say, this is possible. So AI might take people's jobs. It might, I definitely say to secondary school students, you need to think very carefully about what career you're going into. You definitely need a plan B. I'm obviously a fan of polymaths. Get good at lots of things. Maybe get qualified in lots of things. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Most people are interested in more than one thing anyway, but it could keep us alive. It could, particularly when married to CRISPR, there are some diseases that have plagued us for all of humankind that could disappear like smallpox did. And so the promise of AI for human health is maybe the best kept secret. People worry about, you know, the Terminator films coming true. But the best contribution of AI, I think, is to medicine. And it's very exciting. And it's so fulfilling and satisfying to go to work every week and be involved in the frontier of these things, be participating in this. There's a sense of calling in that I feel as much as anything I've ever felt.
Yeah. And that really comes across so strongly in what you've shared with us today, Sam. I am gutted we're out of time. I could go on for so much longer, and I know you could as well. I didn't want to leave you, though, without asking you about Mars. It's not often I get to speak to someone who sits on, I believe it's the Mars Society UK. Yeah. We've covered so much ground, but let's end on another planet, shall we? So tell me a bit about what your involvement in Mars is and what the future of that might look like.
Yeah, I love advocating for Mars and human space exploration to Mars in particular. It inspires young people to take up STEM subjects and to dream and to stop looking at all the negative, horrible, terrible things going in the world and then crumble up in anxiety, but then go, you know what, let's make the world better. Let's make the future good and exciting. And that comes through a lot. I was very fortunate in that I got to lean on Lord Martin Rees quite a bit when I was doing my history and philosophy of science PhD. And he's big on human space exploration elsewhere. I mean, on a practical level, it just means putting a lot of events involving astronauts for young people and, you know, trying to promote the discussion. But I think people don't realize that the technology to go and colonize Mars is pretty much all there. There's some really, really exciting tech. You just need the costs to come down and who's going to go first. And I think we're about to enter a new space race where someone's going to want to go there first, because there's so many, all the raw materials for building and some very, very promising materials are on Mars. And it's there are some massive, massive technological problems. I don't want to make it sound easy. But,
sure. If we were to find any kind of life on Mars or anywhere else, would that pose any kind of a theological problem for you or not?
Not for me. Yeah, I was interested to hear that when Billy Graham was asked by David Frost very late in his life, what are the two questions you'd ask God when you get to heaven? And the first one was, is there life on other planets? So I think if Billy Graham can have that question and wonder about it, then the rest of us can do so with full permission as well. I fully believe there is life elsewhere, but I expect it to be microbial. That's the most hardy and resistant form it can take. I think complex life than ours, you've got Fermi's paradox. You know, if it existed, we would have known about it by now, and we don't, so it probably doesn't. I have friends who are involved with the European Space Agency's exoplanet research, and they're using spectroscopy to scan for gases on different planets in the Goldilocks zone that would be indicators of life, and I expect they'll find it. I just don't think it will be as advanced as us.
There you go. Well, Sam McKee, thank you so much for spending some time with us here at Premier, talking about all of the important subjects, life, faith, universe, Mars, space, biology, and goodness knows what else. I think people can really get that sense of passion and excitement for you and what you do and what God has called you to do and how we are living in very exciting times. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for bearing with my sore throat.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.